So, thank you, Catherine, for making it tonight. That's great. I was a little bit worried there. Look, I'm going to let you introduce yourself, Catherine, because the list of your kind of achievements and things you've done is quite long. And I know that I wouldn't do it justice. And I'll let you introduce your topic as well, because I didn't quite get that from Ben. But yeah, so...
I'll give you a 5-minute warning.
Okay, that's fine. This is kind of Reader's Digest version, which worries me a bit because then I don't have proper examples and quotes and such, which if you're an academic, just put your teeth on edge, but there's just not enough time. So, my PhD is in storytelling for computer game design. I am nowadays doing a lot of theater, but also, but I also do a lot of social activism. Like recently, I did something for the International Day of Peace, the United Nations International Day of Peace. And,
Gotta find the right video cable.
Uh-oh. I was loving watching this because it was reminding me of the Harry Potter fan club, of which I'm a member. They advertised that they had a Scrabble Day once a month where you turn up at a food court here in the city and you could play Harry Potter Scrabble. I thought, sounds like fun. So I turned up, and next thing you know, I'm all their best friend, and every meeting they go through, well, Daniel Radcliffe is in a new movie called Frankenstein where he plays Igor. And I'm, ooh, Daniel Radcliffe, we'll get to see him in this. And then Paramount has a new, Hogwarts school, whatever it is, at their big Disneyland place. It's like, wow! It all looks like that. They look like that. I'm just going, I know where I am. This is geek nerd heaven. Yeah. It's the same thing, only open source.
You got us
sussed, yeah. We're good.
Is it App Software ADP? Is it the one?
Yes. But I'm not a programmer, but I've been involved with computing for a very, very, very long time. As a casual user from about the 60s, 70s, largely because I had an uncle who was a scientist, and he let my cousin and I play on his computer, and we'd play Original Adventure. And my dad was in insurance, and they also played with computers for all their actuarial tables. And he'd bring home the Snoopy calendars every Christmas. I'd have to say, kind of like I'm a bit of a Harry Potter nerd, I may not be a programmer, but I'm a real fan of computing and all the cool stuff. iPhones, I could care less, but what Ted Nelson was doing and what you guys are doing with open source, that gets me so excited. I love hearing about what's coming up and Serval. Oh, I love Serval. I want to use Serval. We can put Serval on my phone, but it was using up energy like nobody's business.
Could you tell us what that is?
And it was only me
using it. Telephony over Wi-Fi.
Yeah, and I could use that as a walkie-talkie with my crew at theater productions, right?
Wow.
The problem is, it puts your Wi-Fi into ad hoc mode, and then it constantly has to ping, so it sucks battery.
Yeah. So as I said, I just see this like, this is so clever. You know, this, if it had been used up in Queensland during that flood, you know, they could have just used that all along the way, even though the rest of the communications was down. So I love the possibility. I think I read a lot of science fiction as a kid, so that kind of keeps me excited about this stuff. So anyways, this is called Art and Software, and I promise not to bore you.
Don't think you could.
Yeah. So how are we here? Alrighty. Okay. In 1982, I was employed by the Instructional Media Services at the University of Washington. Not only is that a picture of the University of Washington when you enter from the main street, that little thing right there, my office was directly underneath it. My office.
That was your Wi-Fi antenna?
Oh, 82? I don't know. But we provided the equipment, technicians, and media needed for instruction across the University of Washington campus. I was placed in an all-around role known as a float. I was trained in the use of all the film, slide, audio, and video equipment, as well as how to use all the computer equipment in order to do data entry until such time as I was called out to deliver media. My mother has been a Star Trek fan since it came out in 1966, and I have some good stories about her being a Trekkie. Yeah, I have a set of scientist uncle who let me play the original adventure in about 60s, 70s. And after I ran out of fairy tales, I read absolutely every single science fiction book in my library. I knew that computers don't just do things. Someone somewhere has made decisions on how a computer and its programs work and how they will interact with their users. In 2011, the IBM computer Watson, and you guys I'm sure all know about this, did not beat human competitors in the television game Jeopardy. The combined effort of five programmers with access to the work of hundreds of people who had created and collated knowledge had created a proxy that could effectively represent them and win the game. Computers are tools that magnify our abilities. So it's cool they could do it, but to say that the computer beat everybody, it's like, well, the odds were kind of not very fair, you know, 105 compared to just three other people or whatever the numbers were. At the Instructional Media Services, I started making suggestions as to how their data entry program could work better. They listened to me and paired me up with a student programmer. When the student left, they brought in another. I, in essence, became in charge of the development of their database software. In the 80s, none of us knew that we weren't supposed to be doing that. Microsoft, IBM, and the like were supposed to give us these magical things after we waited a few years. I think that's still a little bit true today, but less so now that people are getting at least a little more aware of open source. At the same time, I became the president of the English Undergraduate Association. We put out a student magazine called Bricolage, right, for all of our creative writing. We had a tiny, tiny budget, which is the story of my life. In order to afford publication, we had to do our own typesetting. To do this, all my creative writing students had to learn how to program in a horrible old language called JustIf, right? And the commands were done in strings of numbers. No words, strings of numbers. It was crazy. I was sent to one of the science building where I took notes and learned the program, and then came back and helped everyone else to learn. We had to get this right, because every time a student made a programming error, the galleys would come back. This was the days where you get galleys and you had to cut them up and paste them, right? They'd come back all messed up, and reprinting from a corrected file was very expensive, right? At least for us on our little tiny insignificant budget. When I first moved to Australia, I was expecting to set up my own publishing house using all the skills I learned at the University of Washington. One turn of events killed that ambition, and one saved me. Desktop publishing exploded onto the scene. Everyone's cousin or neighbor had access to software to do publishing. Few people wanted to pay me for their publication needs, even though I was more skilled at producing a professional final product. Now, I'm not saying this is bad, I'm just saying this is the string of events, okay? Don't kill me yet. At that time, Andrew gave me a copy of Ted Nelson's book, Literary Machines, and I just went bananas. I loved it. I could completely see the point of keeping literature inside the computer rather than printing it out, and the possibilities for hypertext, transclusions, and micropayments. When my parents offered to pay for Andrew and I to visit them in Redding, California, I was as keen as Andrew to meet Ted Nelson in nearby San Francisco. Fangirl time, squee. Ted and his partner Marlene met with us and we hit it off. Before we left the US, we became new members of the Xanadu research team. I arranged for Ted to come to Australia to do a lecture tour, and this led to my being asked to write a book about the internet for Read Books, and put me back in business for a time with online publishing. Woot! And that's the book. And whenever I show people the physical copy, they always find it really cute when they look at the back and it still has a 3¼ disc stapled to the back. All right. At the Melbourne Writers Festival in 1995, I was asked to give a talk about the web. At the last minute, I discovered they had entitled it The Death of the Book. It was the most antagonistic audience I have ever met. And it was a full house. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I told people that the book isn't going away. but ephemeral literature would probably disappear into the cybersphere, such as romance novels, magazines, and newspapers. People's capacity to make a living through magazine publication collapsed almost immediately. Newspapers are now struggling. Romance novels have practically driven e-publication. They're the ones who are doing quite well out of all of this, so I really should get into romance novels, but
yeah.
Harry Potter's the closest I get. However, The Guardian reported in 2014 that the Authors Licensing and Collecting Society in the UK had found that where once there used to be a middle class of authors who were able to make a living out of their writing, over the last 7 years, income has dropped to where the median pay of all authors in the UK is below the poverty level. The author hasn't gone away, neither has the book. However, it is no longer a viable career option for those with the skill and talent to write really great literature, which means we are largely left with the Dan Browns and Jackie Collins of this world. Now, this came out just this morning, interestingly enough. I didn't have time to put it in here, but this is from the Conversation, if you guys heard of that. It's written by academics, all right? It's a way to kind of bypass journalists in order to make sure that what academics were trying to say is what's actually said. So you've got some hope of knowing what it was they were really saying. And here it says, what was it? The top earning quarter of literary authors earn on average $9,000 a year from their writing. Literary fiction authors are the most likely to report that insufficient income from their writing prevents them from spending more time on writing, 70%. Although the top earning quarter of literary authors earn on average $85,000, but the majority of their income comes from other types of paid work, like being a lawyer or something. So that would be more than $85,000. Nevertheless, it's not from their writing that they're making it. So,
is that including like connected things, like doing a writing, a talk, speaking tour, or?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's a good question because my book up there didn't make amazing amounts of money either. But the tour, the lecture touring that I did, yeah, you're right. I made fairly reasonable money. Not an amazing living out of it, but something. It was. You could almost hit, you know, low level, but okay, kind of. As long as I get to do what I love, we're fine. But not everybody is in that position on the subject matter. Surf's Up came out just as the web hit, and because I'm a tech fan, I managed to know about the web before it hit the rest of the public, and was going, "This is so cool! This is so cool! I'm gonna put it in the book." Right? Book comes out, hits the public. The zeitgeist was exactly right. Book sold out the first week. Then they did a reprint, sold out first month. Then they had printed it a third time and had me do a New Zealand edition, and it was crazy. It was really amazing time.
You're telling us you figured it out before Bill Gates did.
Yes. Bill Gates was quite slow to catch up.
So I took up study in storytelling for computer game design, for which I received a PhD. For 7 years, I taught this subject at both RMIT and Victoria University. I didn't feel happy that I was lecturing on this subject without enough real experience. I left academia and ran into a wall that said women, and especially women over 30, are not wanted in the game industry. When Gamergate exploded, I was finally able to get people to understand what was happening. Now, some of it here in Australia is just, you know, lack of dollars. But at the time, our computer game industry was doing reasonably well. But some of the places that were doing reasonably well were misusing their workers, something chronic. And I used to tell my students, yeah, you might get your favorite job making computer games, but you may just burn yourself out after a year or two in that. So anyways, I moved on to musical comedy theater, where I was able to bring all the same skills from gaming into live performance. In 2007, I put up my first variety show, Fly Glass Wings, hoping to turn it into a webcast. The show went quite well, but we were definitely still skilling up on the technology, which is why I'm not demonstrating the technology for that one. It was terrible. At least the filming and the sound kind of went astray, but the show was great. In the mid-1990s, things started to go strange with IBM's operating system OS 2. So with great trepidation, I moved onto Windows for about 3 months. When it crashed, corrupting the first two chapters of my PhD, I insisted on switching to Linux. Andrew said, are you sure? And I said, yes, I am sure. Get me the hell on that. So, yeah, it was 94, 95 that we did this. My primary piece of software at that time became the free Lick typesetting program, which I love to this day. I was aware of Celtec as a new variation on Tech. So from Fly Glass Wings onward, I switched to using Celtec for doing my scripts. And all my and all the various film I make extensive use of multimedia in all my productions. My first comedy festival show, Strange Blessings, was a one-person performance, and it really was. I had to do my own crewing. Andrew helped me set up my laptop with free audio software and create a program that would let me advance my music player using an RC laser pointer, and I had a costumer even make me a bat belt so I could just go like click, click, click from my waistband. GIMP has been my go-to program for graphic design since the 90s, and I use it to make posters, flyers, and web graphics, sometimes in combination with LibreOffice, certainly ever since it was StarOffice, actually. My big theatrical hit so far has been Pop Mashup, Happy Birthday, Doctor. It was a tribute to 50 years of Doctor Who. We performed this for both Melbourne Fringe and Melbourne Comedy Festival, since in these festivals you usually get at most a 20-minute bump in and bump out for a show because others are performing before and after any given production. And if you're working at Club Voltaire, you might have somebody accidentally leave no bump in and bump out time whatsoever, and you just have to hustle. So, to help tell the story, I used Impress, LibreOffice's PowerPoint-style software, to manage music, sound, and video projection on a screen behind my actors. We had a few complicated moments where quick changes between images and sound meant we were also running VLC media player simultaneously. We used the same mixture again for the Harry Potter-inspired show Wizzazz Magic Rocks. Yay! All my friends were there.
All of these posters, of course, were done with GIMP.
Yes, absolutely. And a bunch of pirates. I wish the color here was better so you could see them in their full glory, but I've got them here. Yeah, a bunch of pirates, a trans-dimensional adventure. With pirates, we added the use of, Andrew told me I should be careful because you might get upset. This piece of software I'm about to show you is, in fact, we got it through a Kickstarter and it was only $15 and it's really cool and really sweet. It's called Face Rig.
Yeah, but it's not free.
It's not free, but it's pretty cool. And you do free real-time animation. We used it to put a real-time animated ship's cat onto a screen for the actors to interact with. So it felt very computer game-like.
It does use open standard formats, though, so they do allow users to import their own models and textures
and
animation and stuff.
So we usually try to film these shows and edit the footage using programs such as KDN Live, mostly just for our own purposes, so they're not amazingly well done, but we have them for records. So who's KDN Live? According to Melbourne Comedy Festival statistics, only 10% of shows make a profit. Around 50% break even, leaving 40% who lose money. Very few artists in any field make a profit these days. I usually manage to break even. This is how our culture has structured technology. This is why we love you guys. Okay, technology has given more access to arts, yay, while reducing employment of creators. Right, you only need a few creators to have something that goes out to everybody around the world. Technology has given artists greater access to the tools which are needed to create certain sorts of art outside of the corporate mainstream. Lick, I've gotten a lot of creative writing students using that to put out their poetry magazines and the like. While reducing the demand for independent artists. Technology has given us a means by which digitized works can be widely distributed, but also easily distributed without fair payment or acknowledgement of creators. This is not so much a problem brought on by pirates, but by corporates who have raised the costs of media. Why are we paying this much for ebooks? While reducing the share given to artists. When I was first writing and getting published, we used to get 20%. With Surf's Up, it was between 10 and 15%. Nowadays, you get about 7% off of every book, and yet they have
this
no,
is in deals with whom?
Publishing. And you don't have any overheads. You don't have the overheads that like they used to have with distribution or even just a physical piece of paper or any of it. Right? So they just and they said, oh, but we got more people, so we shouldn't have to pay you more because we can get it out to more people. It's crazy.
I had honestly thought that the artists and the creators of books, authors and that sort of thing would have been getting paid more, so that's just total news to me.
Yeah.
Like it was in my mind, I was going, great, they got rid of the paper, they got rid of the distribution costs and all of that sort of thing, therefore they must be able to provide more money to the artists, but that's completely not the case.
No,
Amazon has total control over what they choose to distribute, and so does Apple.
Yeah.
If I don't like it, you don't get distributed through their stores.
Yeah.
No, is there also the same problem that there is in the music industry, that sometimes the numbers that they actually report to the authors are actually not the actual numbers?
Oh, all of it, everybody, all across the board. Because the thing is people think in terms of fame and fortune and being remembered forever. And also you've got people who just love what they do so much that they're kind of willing to accept almost anything just to be able to do it. And then they're just completely open then to being abused. So it's a tough industry that way. So and technology has given us a world where everyone has the capacity to be a creator, but does not honor the people who have dedicated themselves to excellence and creating a legacy that will represent our generation to the future. Just because someone can write, a little poem, right? Because they know how to write words is not the same as being able to be Coleridge. It's a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of practice. Just like being able to program, it takes time to really know how to get in suite with the programming and make sure you've got things happening as efficiently and as elegantly as possible. So, but it gives people the idea that, I've got the piece of software, I can make a movie. It's like, well, yes, and you're going to need to make a movie and another movie and another movie until finally you've got the skill to make something that's worth remembering. Not that you shouldn't, not that we want to encourage that, but you still need to show a little respect for the people who spent like 50 years working on these things. So anyways, we have been brainwashed into thinking that art is a luxury, not a necessity for our personal and cultural well-being. Impoverishing independent creators is impoverishing all of us in many ways. Technology can still be used to help reverse this. We need to consider, what is art good for? Resilience, our capacity to remain optimistic and engaged. People do need things like jokes and songs to keep them from giving in to despair. Anybody who has problems with depression will understand this. Providing a mirror to ourselves and society, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? Representing the marginalized, who really makes up our society? What are their lives like? What are their needs and issues? Expressing ideas, helping us to think more deeply, holistically, and globally. Also helping us to grapple with values and priorities. Building empathy. Empathy is the first step towards curing apathy. Experimenting with new ways of thinking and interacting. Science fiction is famous for this. Bonding. We have to care and we have to cooperate if we are going to stop things like global warming. Sharing experiences like dancing and singing are a good way of developing social bonds. Preserving our culture. Surely we have achieved things that we want future generations to remember. Certainly more than just Star Wars. If you've ever been to the US, Star Wars Target, Star Wars Safeway, Star Wars every place. When art is taken out of control of the masses, you get propaganda or advertising, distortion, loss of perspective, frozen cultural evolution, manipulation, cultural domination. Only one person's point of view gets seen on television or the big newspapers. Loss of cohesiveness and cooperation, loss of humanity and humane treatment. That's a whole talk in its own right there. When Ted Nelson suggested micropayments, people were terrified of losing the free stuff. They saw it as a one-way relationship as we have been trained to accept by many big companies, when it was always meant to be all way. Anyone could choose to give away their material. Anyone could choose to charge for it. The mechanism was easily in place, without need necessarily of credit cards, to ensure everyone was paid. Now we have YouTube, where people put up their best work, and YouTube makes the profit. As Ted has always said, we're all producers. I have a lot of friends who are understandably hostile toward new technology. They have seen their livelihoods go up in digitized smoke. They have then found themselves subject to suits by new copyright regimes whereby they can no longer build on the past. The technology is not the problem. As I said before, it amplifies intentions. We cannot go back to the quote-unquote good old days when there were no computers. We can only go forward. So what does forward look like? All right. Forward looks like technology that helps us to bond, share, and cooperate. Bonding. I wrote a transmedia television pitch. The show was the original iteration of Wizzazz, a story about a pair of Australian wizards who have formed an indie rock band touring pubs of Australia. It was to be a part computer game, part television show, and part of it would help young people to find venues where live music was being performed by local artists, and occasionally the actors from the show would turn up. So it ends up being a bonding tool. In the same way, Improv Everywhere uses social media and electronic bulletin boards of their own to set missions where people collectively and spontaneously participate in activities that are fun and encourage friendly bonding. I don't know if any of you have participated in any of their flash mobs, but they put it up and people around the world will do things like show up at a bed store and just everybody decides to fall asleep on the beds in the store, right? Or they suddenly decide, they set up where on one day people are going to cross intersections while waltzing. So you get all these people dressed up and they just waltz across. Right? And you know, the people won't know one another when they come there, but they have such a good time, they end up going off to a food court and eating and getting to know one another, and it's great. This is what we want. Cooperating. Already we're using wikis, which provide an amazing way for people to cooperate in the amassing of knowledge. Lumio, which is Kickstarter again, and I paid for this and have a copy, is a software product from New Zealand which helps people to discuss and fairly come to democratic and consensual decisions. They, I believe, are managed to get enough money to be able to give this away to nonprofits and the like. So they're kind of a mix as far as having some money and being free. What we need also at the moment is maybe a sort of dating service for activists to help people find each other who wish to form nonprofit cooperatives. And this software will support them in the process of developing the organization. This is my wish list. Sharing. Don't let Uber, Airtasker, Airbnb, and the like fool you. They aren't about sharing at all, otherwise they would be sharing power with their workers and by forming a cooperative. Andrew will tell you that I get really upset about them. FreeCycle, Zilch, TuShare, and the like, I have been relying on since the early noughties to get free props and set pieces. They help to keep less rubbish going to landfill while ensuring that we have access to some of the things we may need. I've gotten free computer screens, televisions. Actually, the most amazing thing I ever got through FreeCycle, because they'll let you ask once a week for something. Right? You can offer things all week long, right? But once a week you get to ask for something. And I was doing a film where I needed a ninja gi, and I went, well, I'll give it a try. Put it up there, and someone's son had just gone off to university and he no longer needed his ninja gi, just the costume, right? So they just gave it to me for free, right? So I could use it for the film. I was able to do a full-length feature film for $5,000. I absolutely astounded media services. The media services in Adelaide, because no one had ever done that cheaply before. So. In San Francisco, they have Found Fruit, Backyard Forage and Barter Network, and the Free Farm Stand, where excess backyard produce is brought together and given away to low-income families. And here in Melbourne, we have Open Food Network. It's new, it's cool. Go use it. made possible through various apps. We are living in a world where there are fewer and fewer paid jobs. That doesn't mean there is less work. We still need trees planted, children and the elderly cared for, and people who create in ways that help us to form caring communities. This is what our artists do. We don't want people having to do dangerous or meaningless jobs simply to have a job. With a guaranteed living income, also known as an unconditional universal basic income, and more software tools for achieving bonding, cooperating, and sharing, the world will become not only sustainable, but a lot more fun to live in. And these are my various activities, Glass Wings, which is my consulting, but also includes my productions, Sandbox Land, which I'm currently, next Saturday, well no, Saturday week, we're doing Hogwarts School Fete. I don't always do this today. I've just managed to talk a lot about Harry Potter. I don't know. It's getting close to Halloween. Right, but we're having a variety show with jugglers, singers, puppeteers, all kinds of things, which should be good fun. And also friendsinstitute.org, which is basically an open source co-op educational, higher education. We're hoping to help people to, well, what we're doing is we're making sure that students and lecturers and researchers own it. It's scholar-owned education as opposed to being owned by the government or owned by administration.
How does that ownership take place? Like, if, let's say I'm a student, how do I own the institution?
Oh, just like any credit union or like the...
So through a membership fee?
Yeah.
Right.
Now, mind you, you need to be full-time to have a full membership for being a voting member.
Right.
All right. But if you want to just be on board to kind of hear the papers that are coming out, maybe get involved in the short workshops and such, you can pay a lesser amount for a membership, which isn't voting, but you get all the benefits without the full-time courses.
Yep.
And then people still select people to represent them on a board. And yet you have an AGM where everybody can turn up.
Right. So you one of the assumptions I'm making is that you're avoiding a situation where a very small board of people
mm-hmm.
are making decisions about who is leading certain sections of the university.
Well, that and the thing is that there are this is a whole other talk here. there have been scholar-owned universities since 900 years ago at the University of Bologna in Italy.
I was going to mention that.
Yeah, 900 years ago. They found you had traders in particular who wanted to skill up, and they just hired lecturers, and they said, all right, we're putting you in one place, here you are, we get to come in and learn.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a full-on, but that didn't work very well because the balance was against the lecturers. So the lecturer said, all right, we'll own it, you own it, we'll find a way to share this. And then they have quite a few of them in the south of Europe opened up. In the north of Europe, it was largely principalities, you know, your kings and dukes and such who were putting together educational facilities, right? And at the moment, there in the world, there are two cooperative universities that are owned by the administration and the lecturers. There's one in Mondragon. Any of you have heard of Mondragon? In Spain, where that whole part of Spain is cooperative. A cooperative business is a cooperative university. You just name it. They've gone bananas with that format and have done amazingly well. And then here in Melbourne, there's another one that's academic and lecturer-owned. But I really feel strongly that it's the student's future, and they should have a voice in their education. And they said, oh, well, they're not old enough to know, you know, how to manage this. I'm going, have you been a part of a credit union? How much do you really know about, you know, running banks when you're in a credit union? I mean, honestly. But nevertheless, you know, everyone's going to have to be flexible. The future just changes and changes and changes right now. So we need their voice in this. I mean, you completely bypass the need for a student union when you have that shared ownership. And you then also have a big enough pool of money by including the students on this. that you don't have to rely on a government to, you know, bully you until they say, oh, well, maybe we'll give you money as long as you don't do anything about climate change because we don't want you embarrassing us, right? Or corporates who then narrowed the curriculum down to where they're just turning everybody into cogs rather than doing research that's a benefit to the entire country. Where is our research in solar-powered cars? Where is our research in solar-powered everything? Australia should be the leader in that. It should be just like Germany, like everyone goes, oh, a German car. They go, ooh, Australian solar-powered this or that. You know, and we should have an international reputation in that. So, anyways, go on.
What's that?
Well, we'll just see as we go along as far as whoever fronts up and says, I want to teach this field.
Also, how early are you?
We're pretty early right now with the Friends Institute. I'm already have a few academics who've been speaking with me, and we've already run a little bit of at least one workshop so far successfully, which was one for the UN International Day of Peace, where we taught everybody. We had a group of people and went through a cooperative learning format for learning the UN International Declaration of Human Rights. And so we went through the 38 articles. Is it 38, 32? Even thinking 32 because of computing, that's a good computer number. 38. Yeah, something like that.
I think it's 38.
Yeah, 38, yeah. So yeah, we went through those together and learned how Australia is fucking up. But nevertheless, it was I was sitting there teaching the fact that we would not have a UN Declaration of Human Rights if it hadn't been for Australia. We were one of the eight countries that actually wrote it. And it was an Australian who was the president of the UN when it was passed.
Was that the Doc Evatt day?
That's it, Herbert Evatt. Yeah. So it was we had such a huge hand in that. It's something we should like pat ourselves on the back for. So so that was something that we've already done. We'll just keep going until the whole thing picks up some steam, and hopefully we can get some visibility, and that would help us to pick up even more steam. But yeah, early days.
Are you doing much creative writing on an ongoing basis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, I've just put in a...
I'm thinking of literature.
Literature? Well, yes, literature in the sense of plays. I've got La Mama Theatre in November. Is putting on a monologue of mine, and then next year there is a peace grant that I applied for to do a full-on musical, not just a one-hour festival musical, about elephants. And so that's the next big project, because elephants right now, because of global warming caused by all of our cars, is causing droughts across Africa. So the elephants end up getting into people's fields just because they're starving, something to eat, which puts them at loggerheads. But they're taking up more and more space, people in any case, in order to grow these crops and just destroying all kinds of land and environment and habitat. And then when the farmers find they still can't make a living, they end up in the cities causing civil unrest. And like Syria, Burundi's going through the same thing, the civil unrest. And we're already beginning to get here in Australia refugees from this whole cycle of, you know, damaged biosphere, you know, lack of food, lack of elephants. They actually need the elephants just even for oxygen, because they bring down a lot of the vegetation, and they don't digest very much of their food. They only digest about 40% of everything they eat and then poop out the rest. But the poop is actually fairly important, because that gets washed out along with the rest of whatever it is they're pulling down through their rivers, through the Congo, out into the ocean. So it helps to the Congo to create oxygen, but more important is all of that going into the ocean, giving plankton nourishment to grow. And that's, you know, in the Atlantic and the Pacific, well, Atlantic, largely, that's the lungs of the world. That creates a lot of the oxygen we breathe, and elephants are actually part of that process. So I thought, we need people to understand this. We should do a musical about elephants and get everyone going, oh, like Lion King, and they're going, oh, maybe we shouldn't use cars so much. So we'll see how we go with that one. So this is, yes, I'm showing you here. and then here I thought, does this have sound on this?
It does, but I don't think it's plugged in.
Yeah, not plugged in.
Let's plug it in quick.
Try.
Because I'm
going
to show you at least a little bit of one show before I'm finished.
Show you one of these.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Any questions? I can fix that at all.
Actually, I wanted to ask you, because I'm sorry, I came in late, so it's something I may have missed.
Sure.
We were talking about micropayments for artists.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a name, Ted.
Ted Nelson. Ted Nelson is the man who conceived Piper Media in the 1960s.
Okay.
And Tim Berners-Lee directly credits him for much of what the web is. Right, but when the web was created, it didn't end up including things like transclusioning or micropayments. This is where you have, where for any section of your writing, you can have like 0.001 cent is what it's worth. Right, this is really micro.
Okay.
That way people can quote you, and yet you can still get paid for that quote.
Right.
Right? And then people could reuse and remix media. And it's all the copyrights and such are taken care of. You've already agreed to this, and if someone else uses it, they get a payment for having created something new, but all the stuff that they've used, all those people also get payment, right? And also it's set up so that, you know, if you just write something for fun online, but people really like it, and it goes viral, you will get paid for the fact that it's gone viral, because everyone's a producer. Everyone is a producer. And we've been led to believe that, you know, only a corporation's a producer, and that's just not true. It's kind of like saying there's not enough jobs. Well, there aren't. And there'll be less right now with robotization and things like self-driving trucks in particular. And the U.S. is going to wipe out a huge number of jobs. It's the largest employer in the U.S. right now, at least in all the middle states. That'll be gone with self-driving trucks.
A lot of truck drivers in Australia too.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's going to be a real concern. But why not? Why not? Star Trek world. Don't think in terms of the Victorian England. Star Trek. You know, let's give people. They found when they've given people the freedom to, with a guaranteed living income, they've done trials in Canada, the Netherlands, and India, and they find that when they just give people money, they don't stop working and just watch TV all day. They actually do all the things that they were having a hard time getting done because they're so worried about making money. So granny's taken care of. The trees that need planted were getting planted. You know, all kinds of various activities that the various, you know, towns needed finally got done. And we see this all the time. I mean, you can look out there and, you know, the tagging could be cleaned up. People have decided, I'm just gonna clean that up and just do it. And the more we can encourage a sharing culture where people are engaged in their community, the easier it's going to be to transition to something like that. So
yeah, we've mentioned, I'm sure we've mentioned in past meetings, the Question Copyright organization,
mm-hmm.
questioncopyright.org.
Yeah.
Very much an overlap with free software, that free culture, and especially questioning the copyright regime that the world is under. You reminded me of a piece of merchandise that they've got, a t-shirt that says, I am the content industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Encouraging the idea that you're talking about, that everyone is producing stuff that we should all consider the access that the world has to.
Mm.
It's not just the big mega corporations that control culture.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So you
question up to make. Was Ted Nelson's idea that standardized price per content?
No, you said it yourself.
Okay.
Yeah, everyone. I mean, you can make it free if you wanted to. They were all just going, well, it won't be free anymore. Going, if you want it free, just set it free.
Isn't that kind of part of the problem with the way copyright's out now? Like that Michael Jackson's estate or whatever owns all the songs and charges exorbitant amounts to license it?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't it make more sense to have a standardized price so that?
Well, there's a point. You've got a good point with that, because I run up against that with my shows all the time, right? Because APRA, in this country, you've got Australian Performance Rights Association, right? And I'll put together this. My upcoming show at the Elephants, I'll be writing original music, because then I can just set it free and say, everybody can use this so we can go out there and help the elephants, right? This is a free show. But when I did Wizzazz, Happy Birthday Doctor, Strange Blessings, all of them I had to write out, all right, what's the music I want to use? And I'd send it off to APRA. And then APRA would go, all right, you can use this, this, and this, but you can't use that, right? Because some songs, the creator will retain certain rights and not others. What I'm doing with theater is called grand rights, and not all of them are happy for you to use grand rights. ABBA won't let you use their stuff. The Beatles stuff you can't use. Elton John you can't use. Queen is funny. Some of their stuff you can use. If you contact them, they're lovely. They're really nice to talk to. But David Bowie co-wrote a number of the songs, and anything that has David Bowie is an absolute no. You cannot use it if David Bowie co-wrote it with Queen. Right, and so I then arrange that, and we set up the payment, and usually I spend about $75 each show on using the various songs. But I have to be canny, and I've got to find out early on whether or not I can use it. Otherwise, you know, you end up having practiced the song and find at the last minute you don't have any access to it. And we've had a few times where we've run up against that and had to quickly change things. The other thing is, you got to promise not to tell anybody. You're supposed to use the words as they are written with the original work. Now, at first, when I first started doing this, they weren't that concerned. Then all of a sudden, somebody said, but you realize there's rights in those words as well, and that's a whole new level of rights, and they need to be paying for the words as well as the other. I'm going, but what if we're using our own words? I'm going, oh, well, we have to decide whether the artist is happy to let you do that. Right, now, when I was using Eat It, which is based on Beat It, I had to, it was really tricky because I'm going, do I say Eat It or do I say Beat It? What are we doing here? I went ahead and applied for Beat It. Well, it wasn't Beat It, it was Girls Just Want to Have Lunch, the Madonna song, right? And I said, all right, we'll go ahead and go with, Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Excuse me, that's not Madonna. That's Cyndi Lauper. Cyndi Lauper. Cyndi Lauper. Yeah, Cyndi Lauper. We'll get this one right eventually. Cyndi Lauper. Yeah, and they went ahead. Cyndi Lauper has released all of her stuff. It's fine. So she says, yeah, go ahead and go through. And I didn't tell them I was using the Weird Al lyrics. Oh, girls just want to have lunch. That's all they really want. Some lunch.
Isn't that covered by the Seto?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. But
well,
they don't always
allow
that.
But not in Australia.
No,
yeah. But also, trans copyright isn't meant to be the solution to everything. There's an argument that with the Beatles stuff, for example, there's also the problem that copyright periods are too long. There have been studies done that actually there's a decreasing return to the public after about 20, 30 years. You're actually losing value to the public of not being able to reuse things in other works. The problem is that the TTIP and stuff actually locks in 70 years now for countries that have 50 years. It's actually increasing, ratcheting it up again. Any country that signs up to the TTP has to promise never to shorten the copyright period. So even if they were considering shortening it, like the US was considering shortening to 50, and that's off the table now.
It was 50 before they did a trade deal.
It was,
with museums. Yeah.
And now they're forced to 70 because what happens is the people who want to lengthen copyright, rather than dealing with it at the national level, they put it into the international trade agreements. So they can bypass the national legislatures and just get whatever's in the trade agreement, then it has to be implemented.
It's actually longer than 70th life of the cost.
Yeah, well, that's what I meant.
I don't know what kind of money we'll get, but we're plugged into something that sounded good.
You have to start killing off authors so things go.
Start killing off corporations.
That might be a fantastic
ethical problem.
Well, no audio. Oh no, there it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, still ticked.
So, are we ready?
Yep.
All right.
Get the music contract.
What will we get?
What we always get, guys. Each other.
See, we've got our animation in the background behind them. Magic in the air. That's where we've started changing the lyrics.
don't know what it is I should do. It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. Losing control, yeah, I'm all over the place. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Oh, well, we started out with nothing and we're proud to wear a something fancy.
Song for Wizz Az, so you'll get to see all the plays.
What's the venue?
What's that?
Where is the venue?
Club Voltaire.
In North Melbourne.
North Melbourne.
Ragged Street, North Melbourne.
We'd hoped to turn into a TV show at one time. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.